He didn't attempt to rescue you, Rincewind pointed out as a last resort. He clung desperately to Two Flowers' waist as the dragon circled slowly, tilting the world at a dangerous angle. The new knowledge that the scaly back he was astride only existed as a sort of three-dimensional daydream did not, he had soon realized, do anything at all for his ankle-wrenching sensations of vertigo. His mind kept straying towards the possible results of Two Flower losing his concentration. "Not even Hrun could have prevailed against those crossbows," said Two Flower stoutly. As the dragon rose higher above the patch of woodland where the three of them had slept a damp and uneasy sleep, the sun rose over the edge of the disk. Instantly the gloomy blues and greys of pre-dawn were transformed into a bright bronze river that flowed across the world, flaring into gold where it struck ice or water or a light dam. Owing to the density of the magical field surrounding the disk, light itself moved at subsonic speeds. This interesting property was well utilized by the Soorka people of the Great Neff, for example, who over the centuries had constructed intricate and delicate dams and valleys walled with polished silica to catch the slow sunlight and sort of store it. The scintillating reservoirs of the Neff, overflowing after several weeks of uninterrupted sunlight, were truly a magnificent sight from the air, and it is therefore unfortunate that Two Flower and Rincewind did not happen to glance in that direction. In front of them, the billion-ton impossibility that was the magic-wrought Wyrmberg hung against the sky, and that was not too bad, until Rincewind turned his head and saw the mountain's shadow slowly unroll itself across the cloudscape of the world. "What can you see?" said Two Flower to the dragon.
"I see fighting on top of the mountain," came the gentle reply.
"See?" said Two Flower. "Harun's probably fighting for his life at this very moment." Rincewind was silent. After a moment, Two Flower looked round. The wizard was staring intently at nothing at all, his lips moving soundlessly. "Rincewind?" The wizard made a small croaking noise. "I'm sorry," said Two Flower. "What did you say?"
"All the way, the great fall," muttered Rincewind.
His eyes focused, looked puzzled for a moment, then widened in terror. He made the mistake of looking down.
"Ah!"
he opined, and began to slide. Two Flower grabbed him. "What's the matter?" Rincewind tried shutting his eyes, but there were no eyelids to his imagination, and it was staring widely.
"Don't you get scared of heights?"
he managed to say. Two Flower looked down at the tiny landscape, mottled with cloud shadows. The thought of fear hadn't actually occurred to him. "No," he said. "Why should I? You're just as dead if you fall from 40 feet as if you fall from 4,000 fathoms. That's what I say." Rincewind tried to consider this dispassionately, but couldn't see the logic of it. It wasn't the actual falling, it was the hitting he... Two Flower grabbed him quickly. "Steady on," he said cheerfully. "We're nearly there."
"I wish I was back in the city," moaned Rincewind. "I wish I was back on the ground."
"I wonder if dragons can fly all the way to the stars," mused Two Flower. "Now that would be something."
"You're mad," said Rincewind flatly.
There was no reply from the tourist, and when the wizard craned around, he was horrified to see Two Flower looking up at the paling stars with an odd smile on his face.
"Don't you even think about it," added Rincewind menacingly. "The man you seek is talking to the dragon woman,"
said the dragon. "Hmm?" said Two Flower, still looking at the paling stars.
"What?"
said Rincewind urgently.
"Oh, yes, Hrun," said Two Flower.
"I hope we're in time.
Dive now. Go low."
Rincewind opened his eyes as the wind increased to a whistling gale. Perhaps they were blown open. The wind certainly made them impossible to shut. The flat summit of the Wyrmberg rose up at them, lurched alarmingly, then somersaulted into a green blur that flashed by on either side. Tiny woods and fields blurred into a rushing patchwork. A brief silvery flash in the landscape may have been the little river that overflowed into the air at the plateau's rim. Rincewind tried to force the memory out of his mind, but it was rather enjoying itself there, terrorizing the other occupants and kicking over the furniture.
"I think not," said Liesa.
Hrun took the wine cup slowly. He grinned like a pumpkin. Around the arena, the dragons started to bay. Their riders looked up, and something like a green blur flashed across the arena, and Hrun had gone. The wine cup hung momentarily in the air, then crashed down the steps. Only then did a single drop spill. This was because, in the instant of enfolding Hrun gently in its claws, Nine Reeds the dragon had momentarily synchronized their bodily rhythms. Since the dimension of the imagination is much more complex than those of time and space, which are very junior dimensions indeed, the effect of this was to instantly transform a stationary and priapic Hrun into a Hrun moving sideways at 80 miles an hour with no ill effects whatsoever, except for a few wasted mouthfuls of wine. Another effect was to cause Liesa to scream with rage and summon her dragon. As the gold beast materialized in front of her, she leapt astride it, still naked, and snatched a crossbow from one of the guards. Then she was airborne, while the other dragon riders swarmed towards their own beasts. The law master, watching from the pillar he had prudently slid behind in the mad scramble, happened at that moment to catch the cross-dimensional echoes of a theory being at that same instant hatched in the mind of an early psychiatrist in an adjacent universe, possibly because the dimension leak was flowing both ways, and for a moment the psychiatrist saw the girl on the dragon. The law master smiled.
"Want to bet that she won't catch him?"
said Gracher, in a voice of worms and sepulchres right by his ear. The law master shut his eyes and swallowed hard.
"I thought that my lord would now be residing fully in the dread land," he managed.
"I am a wizard," said Gracher. "Death himself must claim a wizard, and he doesn't appear to be in the neighbourhood."
"Shall we go?"
asked Death. He was on a white horse, a horse of flesh and blood, but red of eye and fiery of nostril. He stretched out a bony hand and took Gracher's soul out of the air and rolled it up until it was a point of painful light. And then he swallowed it. Then he clapped spurs to his steed, and it sprang into the air, sparks coruscating from its hooves.
"Lord Gracher," whispered the old lawmaster as the universe flickered around him.
"That was a mean trick,"
came the wizard's voice, a mere speck of sound disappearing into the infinite black dimensions.
"My lord, what is death like?" called the old man tremulously.
"When I have investigated it fully, I will let you know,"
came the faintest of modulations on the breeze.
"Yes," murmured the law master. A thought struck him. "During daylight, please," he added.
"You clowns!" screamed Hrun from his perch on Nine Reed's foreclaws.
"What did he say?"
roared Rincewind as the dragon ripped its way through the air in the race for the heights.
"Didn't hear!"
bellowed Twoflower, his voice torn away by the gale. As the dragon banked slightly, he looked down at the little toy spinning top that was the mighty Wyrmberg, and saw the swarm of creatures rising in pursuit. Nine Reed's wings pounded and flicked the air away contemptuously. Thinner air, too. Twoflower's ear popped for the third time. Ahead of the swarm, he noticed, was a golden dragon. Someone on it, too.
"Hey, are you all right?" said Rincewind urgently.
He had to drink in several lungfuls of the strangely distilled air in order to get the words out.
"I could have been a lord, and you clowns had to go and—"
Hrun gasped as the chill thin air drew the life even out of his mighty chest.
"What's happening to the air?"
muttered Rincewind. Blue lights appeared in front of his eyes.
"Huh?"
said Twoflower, and passed out. The dragon vanished. For a few seconds the three men continued upwards, Twoflower and the wizard presenting an odd picture as they sat one in front of the other with their legs astride something that wasn't there. Then what passed for gravity on the disc recovered from surprise and claimed them. At that moment Liesa's dragon flashed by, and Hrun landed heavily across its neck. Liesa leaned over and kissed him. This detail was lost to Rincewind as he dropped away with his arm still clasped round Twoflower's waist. The disc was a little round map pinned against the sky. It didn't appear to be moving, but Rincewind knew that it was. The whole world was coming towards him like a giant custard pie.
"Wake up!" he shouted above the roar of the wind. "Dragons! Think of dragons!"
There was a flurry of wings as they plummeted through the host of pursuing creatures, which fell away and up. Dragons screamed and wheeled across the sky. No answer came from Twoflower. Rincewind's robe whipped around him, but he did not wake. Dragons, thought Rincewind in a panic. He tried to concentrate his mind, tried to envisage a really lifelike dragon. If he can do it, he thought, then so can I. But nothing happened. The disc was bigger now, a cloud-swirled circle rising gently underneath them. Rincewind tried it again, screwing up his eyes and straining every nerve in his body. A dragon. His imagination, a somewhat battered and overused organ, reached out for a dragon. Any dragon.
It won't work. You don't believe in them.
Rincewind looked at the terrible mounted apparition grinning at him, and his mind bolted in terror. There was a brilliant flash. There was utter darkness. There was a soft floor under Rincewind's feet, a pink light around him, and the sudden shocked cries of many people. He looked around wildly. He was standing in some kind of tunnel, which was mostly filled with seats, in which outlandishly dressed people had been strapped. They were all shouting at him.
"Wake up," he hissed. "Help me."
Dragging the still unconscious tourist with him, he backed away from the mob until his free hand found an oddly shaped door handle. He twisted it and ducked through, then slammed it hard. He stared around the new room in which he found himself, and met the terrified gaze of a young woman who dropped the tray she was holding and screamed. It sounded like the sort of scream that brings muscular help. Rincewind, awash with fear-distilled adrenaline, turned and barged past her. There were more seats here, and the people in them ducked as he dragged Twoflower urgently along the central gangway. Beyond the rows of seats were little windows. Beyond the windows, against a background of fleecy clouds, was a dragon's wing. It was silver. "I've been eaten by a dragon," he thought. "That's ridiculous," he replied. "You can't see out of dragons." Then his shoulder hit the floor at the far end of the tunnel, and he followed it through into a cone-shaped room that was even stranger than the tunnel. It was full of tiny, glittering lights. Among the lights, in contoured chairs, were four men who were now staring at him open-mouthed. As he stared back, he saw their gazes dart sideways. Rincewind turned slowly. Beside him was a fifth man, youngish, bearded, as swarthy as the nomad folk of the Great Neff.
"Where am I?" said the wizard. "In the belly of a dragon?"
The young man crouched back and shoved a small black box in the wizard's face. The men in the chairs ducked down.
"What is it?" said Rincewind.
"A picture box." He reached out and took it, a movement which appeared to surprise the swarthy man, who shouted and tried to snatch it back. There was another shout, this time from one of the men in the chairs, only now he wasn't sitting. He was standing up, pointing something small and metallic at the young man. It had an amazing effect. The man crouched back with his hands in the air.
"Please give me the bomb, sir," said the man with the metallic thing. "Carefully, please."
"This thing?" said Rincewind. "You have it. I don't want it."
The man took it very carefully and put it on the floor. The seated men relaxed, and one of them started speaking urgently to the wall. The wizard watched him in amazement.
"Don't move," snapped the man with the metal.
An amulet, Rincewind decided. It must be an amulet. The swarthy man backed into the corner.
"That was a very brave thing you did," said Amulet Holder to Rincewind. "You know that?"
"What?"
"What's the matter with your friend?"
"Friend?"
Rincewind looked down at Twoflower, who was still slumbering peacefully. That was no surprise. What was really surprising was that Twoflower was wearing new clothes. Strange clothes. His breeches now ended just above his knees. Above that, he wore some sort of vest of brightly striped material. On his head was a ridiculous little straw hat with a feather in it. An awkward feeling around the leg regions made Rincewind look down. His clothes had changed too. Instead of the comfortable old robe so marvellously well adapted for speed into action in all possible contingencies, his legs were encased in cloth tubes. He was wearing a jacket of the same grey material. Until now, he'd never even heard the language the man with the amulet was using. It was uncouth and vaguely hublandish. So why could he understand every word? Let's see, they'd suddenly appeared in this dragon after they'd materialized in this dragon. They had struck up a conversation in the airport so naturally. They had chosen to sit together on the plane, and he'd promised to show Jack Zweiblumen around when they got back to the States. Yes, that was it. And then Jack had been taken ill, and he'd panicked, and come through here and surprised this hijacker. Of course. What on earth was hublandish? Dr. Reinswand rubbed his forehead. What he could do with was a drink. Ripples of paradox spread out across the sea of causality. possibly the most important point that would have to be borne in mind by anyone outside the sum totality of the multiverse, was that although the wizard and the tourist had indeed only recently appeared in an aircraft in mid-air, they had also, at one and the same time, been riding on that aeroplane in the normal course of things. That is to say, while it was true that they had just appeared in this particular set of dimensions, it was also true that they had been living in them all along. It is at this point that normal language gives up and goes and has a drink. The point is that several quintillion atoms had just materialized, however they had not, see below, in a universe where they should not strictly have been. The usual upshot of this sort of thing is a vast explosion, but since universes are fairly resilient things, this particular universe had saved itself by instantaneously unravelling its space-time continuum back to a point where the surplus atoms could safely be accommodated, and then rapidly rewinding back to that circle of firelight which, for want of a better term, its inhabitants were wont to call the present. This had, of course, changed history. There had been a few less wars, a few extra dinosaurs and so on, but on the whole, the episode passed remarkably quietly. Outside of this particular universe, however, the repercussions of the sudden double-take bounced to and fro across the face of the sum of things, bending whole dimensions and sinking galaxies without a trace. All this was, however, totally lost on Dr. Reinsvand, 33, a bachelor, born in Sweden, raised in New Jersey, and a specialist in the breakaway oxidation phenomena of certain nuclear reactors. Anyway, he probably wouldn't have believed any of it. Zweiblumen still seemed to be unconscious. The stewardess, who had helped Reinsvand to his seat, to the applause of the rest of the passengers, was bending over him anxiously.
"We've radioed ahead," she told Reinsvand. "There'll be an ambulance waiting when we land. It says on the passenger list that you're a doctor."
"I don't know what's wrong with him," said Reinsvand hurriedly. "It might be a different matter if he was a Magnox reactor, of course. It is a shock of some kind."
"I've never..."
Her sentence terminated in a tremendous crash from the rear of the plane. Several passengers screamed. A sudden gale of air swept every loose magazine and newspaper into a screaming whirlwind that twisted madly down the aisle. Something else was coming up the aisle. Something big, and oblong, and wooden, and brass-bound. It had hundreds of legs. If it was what it seemed, a walking chest of the kind that appeared in pirate stories, brim-full of ill-gotten gold and jewels, then what would have been its lid suddenly gaped open. There were no jewels, but there were lots of big, square teeth, white as sycamore, and a pulsating tongue, red as mahogany. An ancient suitcase was coming to eat him. Reinsvand clutched at the unconscious Zweiblumen for what little comfort there was there, and gibbered. He wished fervently that he was somewhere else. There was sudden darkness. There was a brilliant flash. The sudden departure of several quintillion atoms from a universe that they had no right to be in anyway caused a wild imbalance in the harmony of the sun totality, which it tried frantically to retrieve, wiping out a number of sub-realities in the process. Huge surges of raw magic boiled uncontrolled around the very foundations of the multiverse itself, welling up through every crevice into hitherto peaceful dimensions and causing novas, supernovas, stellar collisions, wild flights of geese, and drowning of imaginary continents. Worlds as far away as the other end of time experienced brilliant sunsets of coruscating octarine as highly charged magical particles roared through the atmosphere. In the cometary halo around the fabled ice system of Zeret, a noble comet died as a prince flamed across the sky. All this was, however, lost on Rincewind, as, clutching the inert two-flower around the waist, he plunged towards the disk's sea several hundred feet below. Not even the convulsions of all the dimensions could break the iron law of the conservation of energy, and Reinsvand's brief journey in the plane had sufficed to carry him several hundred miles horizontally, and 7,000 feet vertically. The word plane flamed and died in Rincewind's mind. Was that a ship down there? The cold waters of the Circle Sea roared up at him and sucked him down into their green, suffocating embrace. A moment later there was another splash as the luggage, still bearing a label carrying the powerful travelling rune TWA, also hit the sea. Later on, they used it as a raft. Close to the edge. It had been a long time in the making. Now it was almost completed, and the slaves hacked away at the last clay remnants of the mantle. Where other slaves were industriously rubbing its metal flanks with silver sand, it was already beginning to gleam in the sun with the silken organic sheen of young bronze. It was still warm, even after a week of cooling in the casting pit. The arch-astronomer of Krull motioned lightly with his hand, and his bearers set the throne down in the shadow of the hull. "Like a fish," he thought. "A great flying fish. And of what seas?" "It is indeed magnificent," he whispered. "A work of true art."
"Craft," said the thickest man by his side. The arch-astronomer turned slowly and looked up at the man's impassive face. It isn't particularly hard for a face to look impassive when there are two golden spheres where the eyes should be. They glowed disconcertingly.
"Craft, indeed," said the astronomer, and smiled. I would imagine that there is no greater craftsman on the entire disk than you, Golden Eyes. Would I be right?"
The craftsman paused. His naked body, naked at least were it not for a tool belt, a wrist abacus, and a deep tan, tensing as he considered the implications of this last remark. The Golden Eyes appeared to be looking into some other world.
"The answer is both yes and no," he said at last. Some of the lesser astronomers behind the throne gasped at his lack of etiquette, but the arch-astronomer appeared not to have noticed it.
"Continue," he said.
"There are some essential skills that I lack. Yet I am Golden Eyes Silverhand Dactylos," said the craftsman. "I made the metal warriors that guard the tomb of Pichu. I designed the light dams of the Great Neff. I built the Palace of the Seven Deserts. And yet..."
He reached up and tapped one of his eyes, which rang faintly.
"When I built the golem army for Pichu, he loaded me down with gold, and then, so that I would create no other work to rival my work for him, he had my eyes put out."
"Wise but cruel," said the arch-astronomer, sympathetically.
"Yeah. So I learned to hear the temper of metals, and to see with my fingers. I learned how to distinguish ores by taste and smell. I made these eyes, but I cannot make them see. Next, I was summoned to build the Palace of the Seven Deserts, as a result of which the Emir showered me with silver, and then, not entirely to my surprise, had my right hand cut off."
A grave hindrance in your line of business," nodded the arch-astronomer.
"I used some of the silver to make myself this new hand, putting to use my unrivaled knowledge of levers and fulcrums. It suffices. After I created the first great light dam, which had a capacity of 50,000 daylight hours, the tribal councils of the Neff loaded me down with fine silks and then hamstrung me so that I could not escape. As a result, I was put to some inconvenience to use the silk and some bamboo to build a flying machine from which I could launch myself from the topmost turret of my prison."
"Bringing you by various diversions to Krull," said the arch-astronomer.
"And one cannot help feeling that some alternative occupation, lettuce farming, say, would offer somewhat less of a risk of being put to death by installments. Why do you persist in it?"
Golden Eyes Dactylos shrugged.
"I'm good at it," he said.
The arch-astronomer looked up again at the bronze fish, shining now like a gong in the noontime sun.
"Such beauty," he murmured,
"and unique. Come, Dactylos, recall to me what it was that I promised should be your reward. You asked me to design a fish that would swim through the seas of space that lie between the worlds," intoned the master craftsman. "In return for which, in return..."
Yes, my memory is not what it used to be," purred the arch-astronomer, stroking the warm bronze.
"In return," continued Dactylos, without much apparent hope, "you would set me free and refrain from chopping off any appendages. I require no treasure."
"Ah, yes, I recall now."
The old man raised a blue-veined hand and added,
I lied."
There was the merest whisper of sound, and the golden-eyed man rocked on his feet. Then he looked down at the arrowhead protruding from his chest and nodded wearily. A speck of blood bloomed on his lips. There was no sound in the entire square, save for the buzzing of a few expectant flies, as his silver hand came up very slowly and fingered the arrowhead. Dactylos grunted.
"Sloppy workmanship," he said, and toppled backwards. The arch-astronomer prodded the body with his toe and sighed.
"There will be a short period of mourning, as befits a master craftsman," he said.
He watched a blue bottle alight on one golden eye and fly away, puzzled.
"That would seem to be long enough," said the arch-astronomer, and beckoned a couple of slaves to carry the corpse away. "Are the Chelonauts ready?" he asked.
The master launch controller bustled forward.
"Indeed, your prominence," he said.
The correct prayers are being intoned."
"Quite so, your prominence."
"How long to the doorway?"
"The launch window,"
corrected the master launch controller carefully.
3 days, your prominence. Great Artuin's tail will be in an unmatched position."
Then all that remains," concluded the arch-astronomer, "is to find the appropriate sacrifices."
The master launch controller bowed.
"The ocean shall provide," he said.
The old man smiled.
"It always does," he said.